I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. The winningest manager in the history of the Kansas City Royals has announced he'll retire at the end of this season. Ned Yost will lead the team after securing a World Series win, another series appearance, and a few hundred lost seasons. Today, we'll talk with two sports reporters who have covered Yost and the team for years. We'll analyze his approach with the media and discuss his style of management. Then we take a journey back in time down the Santa Fe Trail to Mexico. Dr. Roland Willard was the earliest U.S. physician to complete the route, and his travel diary provides insights into his encounters along the way. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. It's official out at Kauffman Stadium. Ned Yost, manager of the Royals for the past 10 years, will retire at the end of the season. The move comes as the team runs up another 100-loss season, but in the wake of those two World Series appearances a few years ago. Yost is being hailed as a manager who had the backs of his players, but who at times made questionable strategic moves. His retirement comes as the team is about to change ownership. Here to talk about the Ned Yost years are Max Reaper, who's with the Royals Review. Max, good morning.
Thanks for having me, Steve.
Greg Eklund is also here. He covers sports for KCUR. Greg, good morning to you.
Good morning, Steve.
How big a surprise is this, Greg?
Not a surprise. I mean, with the influx of change at the stadium, really at the top in the next few months, where the owners are probably going to approve a change in ownership, this is not a surprise. What was surprising to me is the fact that Yost has gone this far. He could have stepped down after 2016, the year after the Royals were serious contenders until injuries racked that team, and it was clear that the Royals were facing another rebuilding stage. I frankly didn't think he'd want to go through all that again, but he hung on for a couple more years, and here he is.
You know, Max, for some reason, just based on reading stories about Ned over the years, I had the impression he was in no hurry to leave. Are you surprised he's stepping away now?
Well, he'd hinted at retiring the last two seasons, and he does have interest outside of baseball. He's a big NASCAR fan. He enjoys hunting. But, you know, I think he felt an obligation to the Royals to kind of see this rebuild through a little bit. He wanted to absorb these losses. He knew these would be rough seasons as they went to undergo to rebuild with some of these young players. And so I think he wanted to give his successor a clean slate and allow them the opportunity to get this team back on the winning track without having all these losses on their record.
Having said that, another 100 loss season. This is the third year, arguably, in the rebuilding process. A lot of folks thought we'd see some advancement, you know, in this year, and it didn't happen, Greg. You wonder if some of that weight is falling on Ned's shoulders.
I think some of it is, but it's going to be up to the next person to get things turned around. Even though that this is, call me crazy, even though this is a 100-loss season, I really don't think the Royals are that far away from at least getting themselves closer to 500 or in a position in this division, which is possible because this division is one of the mediocre divisions of the American League. Mm-hmm. If you put yourself in serious contention in August or September, you maybe, if you don't have a shot for a division title, maybe for a wild card.
Hmm. Do you buy that, Max?
Yeah, I think the Royals we've seen some nice young stars this year. Hunter Dozier has become one of the best young hitters in the American League. Adalberto Mondesi certainly has the great power-speed combination you like. Jorge Soler looks like he's going to be at least tied or perhaps the home run champion in the American League. So there are definitely pieces to build around. Whit Merrifield, of course, the all-star. So there's definitely pieces to build around, and it'll be interesting to see with new ownership how they supplement that team because, you know, it's a small market team, so I don't know if they're going to be aggressive in free agency, but there are definitely the building blocks there that a new manager can work with.
I don't want to get too far afield here, but what should fans expect with new ownership, Max, as you look at this? There is this idea that a new owner takes on debt when he acquires a team. At the same time, you have a sense that maybe there's hope anyway that the new ownership team won't be as tight-fisted with a buck, might be more aggressive in terms of going after better players. What should a fan expect?
Well, we don't really know that much about John Sherman. He hasn't been a very public personality so far. But what we've heard so far is pretty encouraging. He was a minority owner with the Indians, who are a very well-run organization. And they haven't been a free-spending team, but they are a sustainable winner that is competitive year in and year out. So I think we're expecting him to be a very innovative owner, one that's kind of on the cutting edge of baseball, and one that's open to new ideas. So I think that's very encouraging. And the fact that he's a Kansas Cityan, a season ticket holder, a baseball fan, I think that gives us encouragement that he's going to see the team as a civic asset and not just a line on a balance sheet.
What do you expect, Greg, as you look at this new ownership team?
Well, I don't think that John Sherman is going to be a free spender, because I just look at what the Indians have done in the last few years. They've pared down salaries as well. They've let some good players go, either through trades. Now, when they were in contention a couple months ago, they went out and got some guys like they did in 2016 when the Indians went to the World Series. Sherman was part of that when the Indians made some stretch-run acquisitions like the Royals did in 2015 to put them over the hump. But I don't think he's going to be spending a lot of money. I think he's going to be very judicious with the amount of money that goes out in the open market.
Let's go back to Ned Yost. How rare is it, Max, for a Major League Baseball manager these days to survive 10 years in the job, as Ned Yost did here with the Royals the last decade?
It is a little bit unusual, and we've seen kind of a changing of the guard. We've seen Bruce Bochy, the manager who he faced in the 2014 World Series with the Giants, he's also stepping down this year. So there is a little bit of a changing guard. It's become kind of a young man's game. We've seen a lot of managers under the age of 40 who are younger and younger. And so, to see a guy like Ned Yost endure, and remember all the critics that he had early in his career, I think it's, I think if you had told me 10 years ago that he would last this long, I'd be quite surprised. But he's endured, and I think his success and his belief in his players and how he fits in this organization is a big testament to that.
10 years ago, what were critics saying about him?
Well, he had a reputation coming over from Milwaukee, the first place he managed, as Nervous Ned. He was fired from a very good team with 2 weeks to go before the postseason. So I think he learned a lot from that experience. I think back then he was meddling a little bit too much, not trusting his players. And he came to Kansas City and really learned to delegate, empower his players, and believe in his players. And I think that attitude really helped them come back when they needed to in 2014 and 2015 when their backs were up against the wall.
When you say delegate, you mean what?
Well, for example, he often gave his players permission to bunt whenever they felt like they could get a hit or to sacrifice a guy over. A lot of the guys had the green light to steal. So I think he a lot of times trusted his players to make the right decision. And I think that made a big difference. For example, when they were down in the wild card game, I think his belief in them gave them the confidence that we can come back from this, even though the odds are against us. And I think that made a big difference.
This is the 2014 wild card game against the A's that will go down in Royals history as this incredible comeback going forward. Yeah. People forget this unceremonious dumping in Milwaukee, Greg. Max alluded to it. How did that shape him? Any sense of how that impacted him? Because his team was going to the playoffs and ownership dumped him, as Max said, with 2 weeks to go in the season.
Yeah, I think that affected him greatly, although I don't think he totally shook some of those traits when he started out his managerial career in Kansas City. I think it took him even a little bit of time to evolutionize himself as a manager, even while he was in Kansas City. I think this team that he nurtured along, that became the team that won the World Championship, was a team that he had a lot of control over in the beginning when they were coming up from the minor leagues. But then I think as they grew, he allowed their personalities to develop and allowed their personalities not only to develop within the clubhouse, but in the way they played the game on the field.
Could you guys talk just for a moment about the whole job of being a manager? Because it strikes me that, man, I guess like playing Major League Baseball as a player, being a manager, Max, is a grind. Sam Mellinger in his column on Ned Yost today points out that, Ned had to meet with the media four times a game. So you do that 162 times a season.
That could have been consolidated, though. He spent one session separately with the print than from electronic media, so you can consolidate that and cut that in half if you want to.
Yeah. But still, what kind of grind is that job?
Well, he was, it reflected in his attitude. He was very prickly with the media early on.
Was he?
In his career, I think very combative at points. I think once he had some success and won a World Series, I think you saw a much more relaxed Ned. he was still verbally sparring with media members, but it was more of a kind of, I'm not serious, you know, I'm not, you know, mean. It was non-mean-spirited. So I think he kind of enjoyed that back and forth a little bit. But yes, you're absolutely right. It was a grind. And I think that's part of why he gets so much credit for managing that clubhouse, keeping guys on an even keel, and like I said, empowering those players to make the right decisions. And I think that counts over 162-game schedule.
Sam Mellinger pointed out that Ned Yost sparring with the media was just sort of an exercise in sort of futility. He would make he would say, no, that's not the case. He would reject the premise of a question only to sort of endorse what the questioner was asking as he answered in response. And the whole thing was just kind of convoluted. He was just objecting to the question to object to it.
Right. I think sometimes he was just kind of messing with members of the media just to mess with them. But that was kind of like his personality. I think part of why he's endearing to fans because, he was a guy that there's actually a great article at The Athletic that has a whole list of anecdotes that Andy McCullough, who was a beat writer at The Star, enjoyed with Ned, and their back and forth is great. A couple salty stories in there that just kind of really showed how Ned was as a manager.
What was he like to be around day after day, Greg?
well, you know, as a media member, you certainly had your share of laughs around him, and I have to say that as the years, especially in the years since the World Series, and I would agree with what Max has said about maybe being a little bit, he's got that saltiness, but a little bit more of in a relaxing mode where sometimes you didn't always take him seriously when he would bark back.
Mm-hmm. And you came to recognize when those times were?
Yeah. I think from being around him as I didn't travel on the road on a regular basis, but from being at Kauffman Stadium for more than 70 games a year and seeing Ned on a daily and listening to him on a daily basis, I've come to know his style.
The job is a grind, though, right?
Oh, no question. No question. And he even admitted during the World Series that, even when the team loses, it's not something that he just left at the ballpark. He took it home with him and led to many uneasy nights until he got up the next day and got ready for the next ball game.
Yeah. In his column yesterday, Mellinger also made some other points about him and his successes and advantages and disadvantages he had working with players. He always had their back, Max. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, I remember some early in his career, he had a lot of criticism against him when this is like 2011, 2012. He would never pinch hit for Alcides Escobar late in games. And mm-hmm. Escobar was always a weak hitter, but particularly so early in his career. And a lot of fans wanted a better hitter out there to kind of win the game. And I think his belief was that, okay, I'm looking for the long-term development of these players, and I want Escobar to be battle-tested so that when these games are meaningful and this team is in contention, he'll be ready. And sure enough, Alcides Escobar was the MVP of the American League Championship Series against the Blue Jays, hit something like .414. He led off the World Series that year with an inside-the-park home run. So I think, in a way, you know, Ned Yost, his belief in these players ended up paying off, and he always had that kind of long-term interest of developing these players, guys like Eric Hosmer, Mike Moustakas. When he was struggling early in his career, he batted Moustakas in the number two spot in the lineup, which is traditionally where you want to put one of your better hitters. Moustakas, you know, a lot of fans said, why are you hitting such a weak hitter there? But his belief in Moustakas, I think, led to Moustakas having one of his best seasons, and he ended up becoming one of the best sluggers in the American League.
I know Moustakas is in Milwaukee. Where's Escobar these days?
He was with the Chicago White Sox organization, was with their AAA affiliate, cut in the middle
right?
of the year, and he had some kind of unkind words to say about his experience
there. Well, justifiably, because this goes back to the labor situation that we were talking about. He's playing in AAA Charlotte with the opportunity he thought that he was going to step into shortstop at the major league level if shortstop Tim Anderson, who's an all-star, got hurt. Well, Tim Anderson got hurt. So what did the White Sox do? They didn't bring up Alcides Escobar. They brought up a young player in his place, probably because they didn't want to pay him the money that he would be entitled to if he came up to the major league. So it comes back to the labor deal. At that point, he probably figured, okay, you know, well, what am I in Charlotte for? And he went back to Miami.
So Escobar was playing AAA baseball
yes.
after being a World Series star.
Yep.
You got to appreciate the grind. I mean, he loves baseball.
You know, Ned Yost was also known for making questionable strategic moves fairly regularly. What about his decision to put Yordano Ventura in the game at a big moment halfway through the game? The move backfired. Tell us about that, Max.
Yeah, so the Royals were finding themselves down in the wild card game, and Yordano Ventura, of course, was an excellent starting pitcher that year. But he had pitched, I think 2 days previous to the game. And Ned Yost, looking for answers, he had a tremendous bullpen out there, but he decided to go with Yordano Ventura in the middle innings, which brought howls of criticism from many fans.
Taking a starting pitcher and making him a relief pitcher all of a sudden
in a huge game.
Right. Yeah.
And one of my writers actually joked, Ned Yost may be the first manager fired in the middle of a playoff game. I mean, if that didn't work out, I think that may have been, the end of the Ned Yost story in Kansas City. But the Royals were able to come back. Ventura didn't pitch particularly well, but the Royals were able to make their comeback, and kind of the rest was history. I mean, every single move Ned Yost kind of made after that point seemed to work out all right for him.
So the team rallied around Ned Yost in that game, and if they hadn't rallied, Ned Yost might have been toast, Greg Eklund?
I would agree with that, because, I think there would have been the gallows, figurative gallows would have been in the parking lot had the Royals ended up losing that game.
Hmm. The bottom line, I guess, is at least the Sam Mellinger concluded that the Ned Yost and the Royals sort of brought out the best in each other. Does that summarize it pretty well?
I think so. I think his belief in the players, his belief in the organization, I mean, it all kind of fits together with the template that Dayton Moore, I think, set when he took over this team. It's seeing this as more than a baseball team, more than a business. They really do kind of have a kind of a family atmosphere where they believe in each other. And I think Ned Yost has personal relationships with many of those players that will last beyond their careers. So, I think that's kind of his legacy in Kansas City. There's the winning in the championships, of course, but also I think the relationships he built, and not just with the players, but everyone in that organization.
Do you expect him to remain connected to the team going forward, Greg?
I think in whatever role he decides to take on, I think it'll probably be from his home in Georgia, because I think he's down there to stay this time. A lot of ex-managers, ex-players take on roles as, quote, consultants.
Yeah.
And I think, once in a while, the Royals may consult him for advice, in this day and age of electronics, send him video of somebody, get his thoughts on a minor league prospect or whatever. But I could see the Royals retaining him as a consultant beyond his managerial career.
Who's the next manager going to be?
Well, the early reports have Mike Matheny, the former Cardinals manager, as the successor. The Royals hired him last January as a special advisor, and you have to remember that's how Ned Yost got the job. He, in 2010, the Royals hired him as a special advisor, and 5 months later, he was their manager. Jeffrey Flanagan of MLB.com has kind of said, hold the boat on that. He's not for sure going to have the job. Some internal candidates like Dale Sveum, the bench coach, Pedro Grifol, the quality control coach, will be candidates as well. With new ownership stepping in, I think they're going to do their due diligence. They're going to look at all sorts of candidates. But certainly, there's a lot of reasons to point to Mike Matheny as the guy who could end up getting the job.
If our listeners have thoughts on who the next manager should be or any thoughts on the legacy that Ned Yost leaves behind, 816-235-2888 or tweet us at KCUR up to date. You can't help but wonder if this is the end of the line for general manager Dayton Moore, too. He's been around for a lot of years. Is it, Greg?
I would doubt it, to be honest. I think it would be Dayton's call.
Why is that?
Well, because I think Dayton is entrenched in not just the organization, but in this community. I think with his fingerprints on the youth complex out in the 18th and Vine District and some of the other things that he is involved with around Kansas City, in an attempt to infuse some young talent into the game of baseball for the purpose of getting baseball to the forefront over the long haul. I think Dayton is very dedicated to that as well as rebuilding this ball club.
Do you buy that, Max?
Yeah, I think you know, Dayton Moore has certainly earned a lot of respect around baseball. John Sherman, the new owner, has been around you know, the Royals as a season ticket holder. So I think he's very familiar with Dayton Moore. And I think the rebuild is kind of working so far. I think we look at the minor leagues, they've got some impressive young pitchers that should be up in the next year. Like I said, they've got young players like Dozier and Merrifield that they can probably build around. So I think Moore has probably earned his chance to at least see this rebuild through.
You know, what qualities should the next manager have that Ned Yost did not possess?
Well, I think the modern trend in baseball is embracing the analytics. I mean, I think Ned Yost is always a little resistant to that. I think more recently he started to embrace some of the philosophies, such as the defensive shifts that you see that are so exaggerated out there. But Ned Yost's always a little reticent to embrace those. I think you know, if you're looking at managerial candidates, I think a lot of general managers and owners want a manager who's well versed in those ideas and can communicate those ideas to the players, because ultimately you're having an analytics department does you no good if you don't have a way of you know, translating that into execution.
Yeah. I want to thank Max Reaper, who's with the Royals Review, for his thoughts on Ned Yost and the Royals. Max, thanks very much.
Thanks for having me on.
Greg, I wanted to ask you about a different topic this morning that's making so much news here in the Metro, the NCAA's series of allegations against the KU basketball team. How serious is this? What do you make of it?
It's very serious, because in the NCAA system, because the NCAA does not have subpoena power, if an NCAA investigation is underway and a letter is sent, like in this case it has been, a notice of allegations, in this case, because of the NCAA system and the way it's set up, it's essentially saying that you're guilty. Now it's up to you to prove your innocence. So that's what KU is in the process of doing right now, is trying to make a case for its innocence.
That's a very difficult prospect, you're suggesting.
Because most of the work, the investigative work, is done. And in this case, most of the investigative work was really not what the enforcement staff of the NCAA did itself, but by what it was relying on the testimony from the case that went to court last year.
What's the most serious allegation based on what you've seen so far?
Well, the most serious is centered around an individual named T.J. Gasnola, who used to work as a consultant, for the Adidas shoe company. And it's about payment to certain players in order to influence those players to attend certain institutions like Kansas. And because of some text messages that were exchanged between Bill Self, and there's really not clear evidence. A lot of it is vague. But again, the NCAA doesn't have to have anything beyond the shadow of a doubt. The NCAA can make its own interpretations of how it makes an institution guilty or not.
Just to be clear, none of this will affect the team this season, Greg. Do I have that right?
Not likely. But I think it already has affected recruiting. And KU didn't have the greatest recruiting class going into last season just because of the shroud of the possible investigation that was going over KU at that time. I think it affected them last season, it'll affect them this season and their recruiting, and then the penalties will most likely come down after this season.
You know, Coach Bill Self is fighting back against this awfully aggressively. Again, does he have a fighting chance of beating this thing based on what he's saying?
Well, we have seen that if you cooperate with the NCAA, it can go two ways. Missouri found out that by cooperating, it didn't help them. So KU is taking the other tact. They're going to fight it, and they're taking it out to the public for its public forum part of it to help with its case.
You can't help but wonder how fans are going to be reacting here.
No question. I mean, on the court, KU is going to be a very good basketball team this year. But given the what's on the horizon, it might be the last good season they might have in a few years.
What's the worst case scenario?
Worst case is a possible postseason ban, reduction of scholarships. There could be even be a possible suspension of coaches. The NCAA is also, in many, many cases that the NCAA, when it imposes its penalties, it uses that expression, lack of institutional control. That's the case in this one as well.
And that means what? That Bill Self wasn't overseeing his assistant coaches and others as assertively as he might have?
Correct. And it might not mean that Bill Self himself was guilty of anything, but because of all this happening under his control, that's what the NCAA is citing.
Okay, that's Greg Eklund from Cover Sports for KCUR here. Greg, thanks very much. I appreciate it.
You're welcome.
After a short break, we'll come back and we'll talk about what it was like to travel along the Santa Fe Trail back in the 1820s. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. My newsletter, Kraske Off Mic, is available at kcur.org/Kraske. Get my take on guests and topics from the show and weekly highlights from the up-to-date team. All that's delivered to your inbox each Monday. Don't miss out. Go to kcur.org/Kraske and sign up today. Tomorrow, I sit down with the president of the University of Missouri System, Moon Choi, to talk about the Next Gen Precision Health Initiative, and we'll check the vital signs of the university, too. That's tomorrow on KCUR's Up to Date. Well, he provides us with one of the earliest and best accounts of what it was like to travel along the Santa Fe Trail back in the 1820s. Roland Willard trained as a physician in St. Charles, Missouri, and set off for the Southwest in 1825, passing through the Kansas City area in May of that year. Along the way, he met traders and trappers who were seeking newfound opportunities out west. He also provided the only eyewitness account of the horrific wounds that famed mountain man Hugh Glass suffered in a grizzly bear attack. Glass was the subject of the Oscar-winning film The Revenant. Dr. Roland Willard's travel diaries are now available in the book Over the Santa Fe Trail to Mexico, The Travel Diaries and Autobiography of Dr. Roland Willard, which was edited by our next guest. Joy Poole is the deputy state librarian for the New Mexico State Library and is known as the mother of the Santa Fe Trail Association. The book Over the Santa Fe Trail to Mexico came out in 2015, and she'll appear at the Central Library on Sunday. More on that in just a few moments. Joy, it's nice to have you. Good morning.
Good morning. Top of the morning to you, KCUR, and your listeners.
Well, who was Dr. Roland Willard?
Well, you know, Dr. Willard came out west with a group of explorers, a group of men who were in an exploration company. And he landed in St. Louis as a carpenter and was there for 3 or 4 years, and then was approached by some local physicians in St. Charles to study medicine and become an apprentice to them as a frontier physician. And so he studied under them and went out on house calls and examined cadavers and skeletons and that sort of thing, all learning how to become a physician. He also concocted herbs and various medicines for people at a pharmacy that Dr. Millington owned, and through that 3-year apprenticeship then became a frontier doctor.
Why did he eventually want to go out west?
Well, he lived and worked there in St. Charles, which was only a block away from the state capital when St. Charles was designated, you know, the temporary capital of Missouri. So he heard the stories from the legislators about the silver coins rolling in from Mexico that helped boost the economy here in Missouri. He also heard the local traders and farmers who were having some really tough times had mortgaged their farms to travel out west on the Santa Fe Road to trade, and heard about these riches, if you will, and decided he wanted to take a wilderness journey and make his fortune.
Tell us how you came across these diaries.
Well, that's an interesting story.
Yes,
it came in a form of a letter from Bonham's Auction House in San Francisco, And the letter essentially was inquiring whether anyone in New Mexico could verify whether or not Dr. Roland Willard had lived in Taos, New Mexico for 2 months in 1825. Well, as the mother of the Santa Fe Trail Association, the state librarian handed the letter to me and said, "Joy, please, will you respond to this?" Which I called Dr. New Mexico, a.k.a. Mark Simmons, an author who's well-known and also considered the father of the Santa Fe Trail Association. And between the two of us, we were able to verify that Dr. Willard had lived in Taos for 2 months in 1825. Martin was elated, and as luck would have it, a few months later, I was able to go to San Francisco and actually hold this little pocket diary, you know, that would easily fit in a man's breast pocket, and looked at the content and almost begged Dr. Gammon to please let me know who had the ability to purchase it, because the information contained in it revealed a lot of new information that we did not know about the early Santa Fe Trail trade and travel.
You know, before we get too far away from it, how on earth can you figure out if someone like Dr. Roland Willard lived in Taos, New Mexico in the 1820s for 2 months? How do you do that?
Well, essentially, it was by word of mouth over the generations and publications that were made by local people that lived in the region on the history, you know, of the area. And he was the one of the first American physicians to come into New Mexico. Mm-hmm. And so people were eager to have those services.
So you go to San Francisco, you hold the diary, you recognize that this is something very significant. How long did it take you to realize once you looked at it that this was something special?
Well, I would say it was within the first hour, just as I was scanning the document. I recognized place names. Dr. Willard met over 100 traders, trappers, statesmen, diplomats, governors during his wilderness journey. And I recognized those names from my years of researching the Santa Fe Trail trade and the commerce of the trail.
So you're in San Francisco, you hold the diaries, you recognize their significance, but so how did you go about actually spending as much time as you did with them, and what happened next?
Well, you know, most people, when they go on vacations, will go to the beach, if you will, or maybe go skiing in Colorado.
Not Joy Pool.
Not Joy. I've devoted my career to the Santa Fe Trail, and I found myself going back to the Beinecke Library at Yale University, who had the resources to purchase the diary, and spending some of my vacation times there, working 10-hour days with a magnifying glass, poring over this 4x6-inch diary, written in a very tight clinical penmanship, trying to decipher Dr. Willard's handwriting. Many of the entries, of course, were written by a fire along the trail or in the early morning dawn light as they were packing up the mules and getting ready to head further west on the trail every day.
There's got to be something special about holding in your own hands a diary written by a man who saw so many of these things early on.
You know, you're right. And I don't know that I fully realized the significance of the diary until more time had passed. And as I made more and more connections to events that occurred along the trail, I mean, Hugh Glass is a prime example of that. I had no idea when I first looked at the diary that Dr. Willard had met Hugh Glass. And then lo and behold, a man of that caliber who was attacked by a grizzly bear and managed to live and tell the tale, so to speak. It's fascinating.
But as you're pointing out here, the diaries were not very easy to read. Why was that? They were written in such small script?
Yes. And also, Dr. Willard didn't speak Spanish at that time. So sometimes when he was using Spanish words, he would try and just spell them phonetically. Uh-huh. Also, the penmanship at that time was a lot different than the way we write today. If there were double S's or double F's in a word, he would just capitalize, you know, an F to have it to mean or translate into two F's. He would used very little punctuation, and so sentences tend to ramble. And then he would capitalize words wherever he, you know, maybe for emphasis or significance and that sort of thing. So it took a little bit of, you know, deciphering and an understanding of how people wrote in the 19th century.
I was going to say, how long did it take you to sort of get on a roll and be able to go through his diaries and really understand what he was trying to say?
I would say it took me... Well, the first week was pretty arduous, and I was hoping to get through the whole diary when I was there at the Beinecke and come back with, you know, a typed version. But indeed, it took me a couple of trips back to the Yale University to proofread every word and then places where I couldn't decipher the word to really study it. And sometimes, you know, for 5 or 10 minutes at a time, trying to figure out what he was trying to say.
I bet you wanted to ask him a few times.
Yes, I did, of course.
So somebody just picking up one of these diaries, Joy, and would have a pretty tough time trying to figure out what the good doctor was trying to say here.
I think so. And I will say that the good fortune that I had, you know, at the time I wondered, but at first I was just focused on the diary. But when I went back to Yale University, the curator said, "Hey, Joy, you know, there's more to that collection than just the diary." Well, I was only focused on the Santa Fe Trail diary. And lo and behold, I realized that Dr. Willard had written an autobiography years later, which expanded on these entries that he had written very quickly in the trail diary. And so between the autobiography also contributed to my ability to interpret or decipher some of the words that I couldn't understand in the diary. So between those two documents, I was able to make quite a bit of progress. And I will also say, as Dr. Willard got older, his penmanship got larger. So that helped a lot.
Eyesight's not as good. Maybe gets a little bigger so he can read it then, eh?
You bet. Yeah. You bet.
Joy Poole's my guest. She's the deputy state librarian for the New Mexico State Library. She's also the editor of the book Over the Santa Fe Trail to Mexico, which came out in 2015. She'll be speaking about her book at 2 o'clock on Sunday at the Central Library downtown, 14 West 10th Street. More information is online at kclibrary.org. If you have a question for Joy, our number here, 816-235-2888, or you can tweet us at KCUR up to date. Now, Joy, Missourians had only recently, at least back at this time, begun to trade on the Santa Fe when Dr. Willard set out. That's how new this experience was to anyone in Missouri, right?
That's correct. You know, William Becknell started from Old Franklin, Missouri in 1821, and he was up to his eyeballs in debt. And so I think people in Missouri knew that Mexico was fighting a war for their independence with Spain. And I bet on a hunch he took off on the trail with five other men and hung out on the Arkansas River, which was the international border between the U.S. and Spain at that time, waiting to see would Mexico gain its independence. And sure enough, they did, and Becknell ventured then on down into New Mexico and was very successful. The governor did want to trade with Missouri and wanted the merchandise and manufactured goods that Americans could bring across the trail to the inhabitants of New Mexico. And so an international trail of commerce was born, or as Senator Thomas Hart Benton once said, it was a highway between nations.
Huh. The group he traveled with was divided into two groups. Describe those to us.
Well, you know, the men, when they were traveling on these spring caravans out to New Mexico, would often travel in groups for protection against Plains Indians as they went through Indian territory. And this particular spring, the men decided to meet in the upper reaches of Missouri, which was Fort Osage. And over 130 men gathered there. A lot of them didn't have wagons. They maybe only had a horse or some pack mules to carry inventory across the trail. And others had realized that if they could load cargo or inventory into wagons, they could make a lot more money because those wagons could hold up to 2 tons of inventory.
Huh.
So anyway, they essentially broke up into two groups. The wagons, of course, traveling much slower than the men on horses and or with pack mules. And they called that advanced group that went out ahead of the wagons the packers. And then the wagon caravan followed probably a week or 2 weeks later.
Hmm.
And I will also say that the packers, once they got to New Mexico, rather than going straight to Santa Fe, they were headed straight to Taos on a Spanish trace that would take them to a good hot bath and to obtain some Taos white lightning, so to speak, and to reach civilization and actually probably sleep in a bed and get out of the elements, so to speak.
White lightning, Joy, what is that?
White lightning was distilled whiskey that was manufactured by Simeon Turley there outside of Taos, New Mexico. And it was well known among the mountain men, believe me.
I can only imagine. What surprised you the most about his descriptions of life on the trail and who he encountered along the way?
Well, I'd have to say there were a couple aha moments for me. One was actually meeting Hugh Glass and giving Hugh Glass a physical examination after that horrific grizzly bear attack. Dr. Willard, when he went out on the trail, he camped for the first time in his life at Camp Osage or Fort Osage. And then the very next day, he meets Hugh Glass, along with some other mountain men who are waiting for him at waiting for the spring caravan to come west from he's waiting there at Blue Springs. And as soon as Hugh Glass learns that Dr. Willard is a physician, he starts regaling him with stories of this grizzly bear attack. Now, and Dr. Willard, he strips down buck naked for Dr. Willard, and Willard examines him right there on the Santa Fe Trail at Blue Springs. Now, can you imagine? This physician had camped out for the first time in his life the night before, and then he meets Hugh Glass, who's been attacked and survived a grizzly bear attack, and he can see all the deformities on the man's body from that attack. I can only imagine what Dr. Will was maybe having second thoughts about going on this wilderness journey to make his fortune in a foreign country.
How bad were the wounds from the bear attack?
Pretty significant. He described that the shoulder blade of Hugh Glass was missing, and that one side of his leg on his thigh was missing its muscles. And other, you know, scars and deformities from those big, huge bear claws just basically grabbing Hugh Glass's body and ripping, you know, segments of it apart.
You just can't help but wonder how he survived.
Exactly. Tough, tough, tough man. And the other interesting thing was that he was a Scotsman, and he had his kilt and his cap from Scotland and apparently wore them across the trail. Dr. Willard apparently had a great deal of respect for Hugh Glass, and he affectionately referred to him as Father Glass.
Wow. Who else did he encounter along the way that really struck you, Joy?
Well, he encountered, curiously enough, on the Arkansas River, as they were going out, there was a westbound caravan heading to Missouri. And the head of that caravan was none other than Meredith Marmaduke, who would later become governor of Missouri. And with him was a gentleman by the name of Manuel Escudero, who was a statesman from Chihuahua. And Escudero was very well known in the West for his business skills and diplomacy, and also he traded along the Santa Fe Trail and the Camino Real. goods back and forth between Mexico and Missouri.
You know, friends describe you as obsessed with the history of the Old West. I'm wondering why and what fascinates you about it as much as it does.
You know, I'm not quite certain, but I guess I just have the ability to transport myself back in time and have an understanding of some resemblance of what life was like in the American West at that point in time. I am a Westerner. I make no bones about that. I was born and raised in Council Bluffs, and I suppose maybe the exposure to the Lewis and Clark Corps of Discovery as a young girl, and then also my family moved back and forth between Iowa and the Four Corners area of the Southwest. And so as a young girl, we would vacation out in the West. Mm. And I think that all stimulated my interest in history and a love of Western trails in general.
Yeah. Let's go to a phone call here. Michael from Olathe. Michael, you're on with Dr. Joy Poole. Good morning.
Yes, just one quick correction. It's our Kansas River, not the Arkansas River. But anyway, I'm from Larned, Kansas, where Fort Larned is, and down from Pawnee Rock, Kansas, which is supposed to be the halfway point of the Santa Fe Trail. I was just wondering if you knew any history about the place locally there. I think Pawnee Rock is said to have a chimney rock there, and the Santa Fe Railroad knocked it down, used it for gravel on the railroad there.
Joy.
Yeah, Michael, you're correct. Here's because Dr. Roland Willard traveled in 1825, a lot of those place names along the Santa Fe Trail had not even been named then. Fort Larned wouldn't come into being until maybe a decade later. And then, of course, the fort itself was in the 1860s. So, that was one of the trickiest parts of deciphering this diary, was truly gauging the amount of miles that he traveled every day and then trying to insert the modern day place name of that campsite on the Santa Fe Trail.
Dr. Willard certainly had a sense of history himself and the importance of what he had seen and done, because he was so careful to keep these diaries. Does that make sense, Joy?
No, I didn't quite understand the question,
Dr. Willard, the fact that he kept such meticulous diaries, he too must have had a sense of history that what he was doing was worth preserving.
I believe so. When he started out he was born and raised in New York, and when he started out with the young men on the exploration company, he actually kept a diary of that 1,500-mile journey down the Allegheny and the Ohio River.
Wow.
And then when he started on this other wilderness journey, he also kept a recording of his diary. And I suspect it was because he had read maybe Zebulon Pike's account of his expedition, and also the Lewis and Clark Corps of Discovery exploration papers. And so he had a sense that, maybe he too would be contributing to, the historical knowledge of the American West.
That's Dr. Joy Poole. Her book, Over the Santa Fe Trail to Mexico, The Travel Diaries and Autobiography of Dr. Roland Willard. Again, she speaks at 2 Sunday at the Central Library downtown, 14 West 10th Street. More information, kclibrary.org. Joy, what a pleasure to have you. Thanks for taking the time. I appreciate it.
Hey, thank you. 2021 is the 200th anniversary of the Santa Fe Trail, so I hope your listeners will venture out west like Dr. Willard did.
That sounds great. Thanks again, Joy.
Bye-bye.
Tomorrow, New York Times political commentator David Brooks will be here, and I'm not sure we'll get through everything I want to talk about, but we'll give it a try. Our show is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Elizabeth Ruiz, and Jamie Hobbs. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.